Good morning. Service in the United States Armed Forces is no hedge against deportation, as a number of both veterans and active duty personnel have learned. Immigrants who serve do not have the same rights as citizens. Many who enlist see their service as a pathway to citizenship, and for many, it is. But there's a growing community of deported veterans who have been taken by surprise and are finding themselves having to start over in a new country. Claire Hanos is an immigration attorney who is here to help us sort it all out. Good morning, Claire. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You've seen this at first hand with your clients, right?
I have. It's a growing group of people, and it's a group of people who are getting more attention, are deported veterans. Mm-hmm. And there are no numbers, no concrete statistics on how many veterans have been deported from the United States, but it's probably at least a few thousand.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of non-U.S. citizens in the military in the United States are Filipino and Mexicans. And mm-hmm. so there are so many that have been sent back to Mexico that in Tijuana they've even formed a deported veteran support group. There are some in Congress who are working on legislation to try to ensure that no veterans ever get deported for nonviolent crimes.
Mm-hmm.
But in the anti-immigrant climate that we're living in today, that's going to be a very, very tough sell.
Those deportees, they didn't get deported because they had green cards. Something else happened. They got in trouble. They got a couple of criminal offenses on their record.
Right. So I think, just kind of for a big picture, most people in the U.S. Armed Services are U.S. citizens, the vast majority, probably 95%.
Mm-hmm.
4 to 5%, the rest are non-citizens. Most of them are green card holders,
right.
Lawful permanent residents. And lawful permanent residents, if certain laws are broken, are subject to deportation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it can be pretty obvious. You think about something like a murder or something really bad. But oftentimes it can be for something as small as minor shoplifting offenses
mm-hmm.
can end someone up in deportation proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
Often military service can be a positive discretionary factor that an immigration judge can consider, but oftentimes that isn't even enough to allow the person to stay in the United States. There are also other non-citizen classes who are in the military. Some have DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival status.
Mm-hmm.
Those are generally, there's about 900 DACA applicants who are serving in the U.S. military right now. And most of them are very highly trained, highly skilled individuals who have specific skills or language capabilities that have been highly coveted by the U.S. military.
That being the rationale for the program in the first place.
Exactly. And those people have come into the military under a program called MAVNI, which stands for Military Accessions Vital to the National Interest,
mm-hmm.
which was started in 2009, realizing that military recruits were down. There was a need for people with specific language capabilities and special skills, and there were those people who were in the United States who wanted to serve in the military but were not permanent residents.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who had lawful entries, people who came as students or came as refugees or had DACA but came as, say, tourists and overstayed, those people were eligible to apply into this. It's a very elite, very small program. And
mm-hmm.
It was really a win-win program for the U.S. government as well as for the individuals who signed up. The U.S. government got a really motivated, skilled group of people.
Yeah.
And those individuals got a fast track to citizenship. However, the program was discontinued in 2016. And that was a very controversial move by the Department of Defense. And there's now talk about canceling the enlistments of 1,800 individuals who are in that program.
Previous administration canceled the program. Is that right?
Yes, it was in the fall of 2016, correct.
So there are a number of people in limbo because of this.
There are quite a few people in limbo because of this who've actually sacrificed a lot. and put their lives on hold to do this military service, thinking that it was going to get them someplace where they wanted to be.
Essentially having been invited, right?
Right, right. Active recruitment,
yeah,
to bring these people into the fold. And so they were needed, they were used, and now they're really being kind of spit out, and they're in limbo. And some of them could possibly face deportation, which is kind of, you know, to add insult to injury. It's a very difficult time for these people.
One of the anecdotes I read from one of the deportees now in Mexico made it sound as if the recruiter, at the time of his recruitment, was only too happy to maybe not dot all the I's and cross all the T's involved in giving him the legal status to become enlisted in the first place.
Right. I've heard that too, that often military recruiters, there's so much pressure to keep their number, to get their numbers up and to keep their numbers up, that they'll promise the world to these people, mm-hmm. to get them to enlist. And so many of them think that by joining the military, by engaging in active service, they are on an immediate path to citizenship, and that it's just kind of taken care of for them.
Yeah.
And oftentimes recruiters have said that, oh, you know, don't worry, we'll take care of it. You know, you do this. And then something bad happens, and they end up in removal proceedings, completely shocked that they as veterans could find themselves deported. And some of these cases are especially tragic. For example, you know, someone who's served overseas in combat and is subject to post-traumatic stress disorder,
yeah,
comes back to the United States and starts engaging in behavior that person had not engaged in before, drugs to kind of ease the pain of dealing with the trauma, or they become more violent in a domestic violence situation,
mm-hmm.
and that ends up putting them on a pathway out of the United States. And for many of them, again, the United States is all they really know, all
yeah.
they remember. Many of these people came to the United States as children.
One thing that their military status does entitle them to is burial.
That's true. It's a strange irony that military veterans have the right to be buried in the United States, but they can be forced to live abroad in a deportee status until they die.
At which time you might be brought home and buried in a military.
Many of them are brought back to the United States to join their families who are living in the United States, for their families to be present at their burial.
Have you had clients who are in a situation where they say, I don't know how this happened, I don't know what hit me?
Yes, and I'm short of explanations for them. You can't go back and undo what was done in the past, and all you can try to do is ease the way out of the United States for them and try to hook them up with support groups in the places that they end up.
I would think that some of their stories would involve variations of promises were made which were not fulfilled.
None of my clients directly, but I have heard that anecdotally through other networks, yes.
Is there an end in sight to this? Is there anything on the horizon makes us think this problem is going away?
No, it's probably only going to get worse. There is, proposed legislation to try to protect this class of people, but it's probably going to not get very far. And again, it was only a couple of days ago that there was talk of canceling the enlistment contracts of close to 2,000 individuals. So, there will be pushback, but things probably aren't going to get better anytime soon. Although we're all doing what we can, and our own congressional representatives have been very strong, generally in favor of the military, in favor of immigrant rights, and
yeah.
So. Our folks are on the right side, but this is a very difficult climate for all immigrants and even in the military during this time where people are needed for recruitment more than ever. It seems a strange time to be targeting people for deportation and targeting people to pull them out of the military who've already served.
Claire, we'll want to keep track of this. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Claire Hannes is an immigration attorney and the owner of Aloha Immigration, a law office providing a wide range of immigration legal services.
What's your view on tourism? It's the top industry in the state, a huge source of tax revenue. About 20 years ago, nearly two-thirds of people agreed that tourism has been mostly positive for me and my family. Now that's down to 40%. What's your view? Call our talkback line at 792-8217 and let us know. We'll share some of your thoughts this week on The Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a newly minted city office with a sustainability mandate. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a public space that was once home to the sport of kings. It was once an unoccupied parcel described as a mix of swampland and arid plain, unsuitable for building. King Kalakaua, a horse-racing enthusiast, decided it would be a perfect place for a racetrack, and wealthy landowners who lived nearby agreed. Led by Scotsman Archibald Scott Cleghorn, a well-connected businessman, they formed an association to spruce up the area, and the king gave them a very favorable deal for the land. Kalakaua granted the association a 30-year lease at $1 a year, and shares in the association were sold at $50 a pop. The resulting park was dedicated as the first Hawaiian public space on June 11, 1877. Within a few years, the nearby beachfront was dotted with cottages leased by association members, and the newly minted park was on its way to being the social center of the Honolulu Horsey Set. This morning, we're looking for its name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
How does a 21st century city adapt to changing times and conditions? How fast does it adapt? Have its leaders prepared for the unexpected? Are systems in place to keep its infrastructure strong in the face of floods, earthquakes, tsunamis? These are all components of resilience, and Honolulu is part of a worldwide 100 Resilient Cities program. Josh Stenbro is the newly minted Chief Resilience Officer for the City and County of Honolulu, as well as the Executive Director for the Office of Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resiliency, and he's here to tell us how he plans to pursue his mandate. Hi, Josh. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thanks. Good morning.
That's a considerable mandate. I was a mouthful just describing it.
I know. My business card is kind of front and back. But, you know, it's actually all thanks to voters who read through all of those words last November and really decided that Hawaii and Oahu had to do something about addressing climate change. And so they voted by an almost 20-point margin to have an office dedicated to addressing climate change and sustainability and all those words that you just mentioned. So we're really honored to be able to try to honor their wish.
Well, how does Honolulu do on that scale, on that resilience scale?
Well, I think that's different for every city. So, you know, we're part of this really unique cohort of 100 cities that the Rockefeller Foundation selected from out of 1,200 applicants. So I think it's, you know, first we should just take a moment to have some pride here that they saw enough in Honolulu to, you know, bring the island of Oahu into this network of 100 cities. And it's Mumbai and Nairobi. And, I mean, it's really an...
This is worldwide.
It's worldwide. And they've chosen 100 cities across the globe to really pioneer this idea of resilience and really provide some technical support to those cities to kick the tires around what really makes, you know, populations more... durable in these challenges that we're facing in the 21st century. And if we can get that right in those 100 cities, then, you know, their model is to push that out to 10,000 cities over time with these chief resilience officers.
To get to resiliency, you have to understand your vulnerability, right?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, resilience, when we talk about resilience, it's really that capacity to survive, adapt, and grow in the face of change and uncertainty and shocks and stresses. So the way that the network thinks about it is there's stresses that sort of sap the energy of populations over time. And for us, you know, look, affordable housing is clearly up there. Sea level rise, you know, those types of long ongoing, it's kind of a longer term problem. But then there's stresses. And you mentioned some of them in the opening, you know, hurricane, floods. You know, flooding. It could be a pandemic. It doesn't all have to be environmental. It could be, you know, a sudden influx of disease. But things that come and then they're gone. Like it could be a wildfire in the West, which is what they're experiencing now. So it's really those two different threats. How do cities become as strong as possible to ride them out and come back stronger? So that the idea is not do you just build back to what you had before, but that you incorporate the lessons from those pieces and then you actually build back to be more durable and strong after the fact.
As you describe that, Josh, I was thinking of the ways in which Honolulu is unique. And I once worked on an emergency plan for what to do in the event of a pandemic, and Hawaii and Honolulu in particular is at extreme risk in that event just because of the amount of people passing through. So potentially just given that one issue alone, potentially Honolulu could be a real disease vector for the world if a pandemic or a similar illness were to travel.
Sure. I mean, we face a lot of different challenges. And, you know, with climate change happening right now as we speak, you know, you've seen this with dengue fever. You've seen this with Zika, where the increased heat actually allows different diseases to come and you know, gain ground here in Hawaii. So we're going to be wrestling with that. What we're really trying to do in this, you know, as we've just launched, really, the office.
Right.
And we've just launched the partnership with Rockefeller. And our first step is really to go out to people and say, you know, what is your perception? What do you feel like the city and the island of Oahu are most vulnerable to? And how are we doing on that?
Yeah.
And then are we actually being active in the areas where we need to act? So we just put up a survey just this morning, actually, and sort of to kickstart this process of getting people's insights into what they think the office should be focused on. And Rockefeller's great. They give us, you know, a full, you know, the several months to really go out and talk to as many people as we can, decision makers, you know, kids, the elderly, everybody, as broad of a group as we can, to find out what the population wants to address.
Yeah.
And then they can bring some resources for the office to help address it. So if people go to our Facebook page, Resilient Oahu Facebook page, there's a link to the survey, and we'd love to have everybody out there fill us in on what they want us to tackle, because the things that we choose, it's not a set program from Rockefeller. It's really we select the stuff that we need to work on, where we see the pukas, where we see the weaknesses, and then we bring the resources to bear to try to work on those.
So it really is a time to weigh in.
Oh, yeah. No, this is the time. I mean, the office is, you know, we've established ourselves, but in terms of what, you know, what we do over the next year is we're going to adopt a resilience strategy. And that resilience strategy is going to cover the whole island, and it's going to point out, you know, where we're strong, where we're weak, where we need to do some work, and then focus down, because we can't tackle everything. I mean, when you think about resilience, when you think about the impacts of climate change, they're so numerous. They stretch across a bunch of different sectors, a bunch of different projects. So, you know, we're going to have to really hone in on those few key areas where we can get the most benefit for the island of Oahu, and really tap the experience of the other 99 cities that are facing similar issues and bring those lessons to bear here on the island. So we need people to tell us what those areas are, and this is their chance to do that.
With regard to climate change, Josh, according to some highly placed members of the federal government, ain't no such thing.
Yeah, well, you know, the people of Oahu know much better. I mean, I think in some ways, you know, we live closer to the land, I think, in Hawaii than in other places. And, you know, Hokulea just came home after an epic, you know, round-the-world Malama Honua voyage. They saw climate change in action all over the planet. They came back, and if you were, you know, down at Ala Moana at Magic Island for that moment when they sailed back into the bay, chicken skin is sort of coming up right now just thinking about how proud it made us. And they saw it firsthand, and I know that, you know, their legacy, the Malama Honua legacy, is going to be how do we prepare our island? You know, you look at Irma, you look at, you know, Harvey, these things are happening in real time right now. Trade winds are down. We used to have many more trade wind days than we do now. Our rainfall is down.
Is that right?
I think folks, rainfall is down about 18% over the last 30 years.
Really?
Climate change heats up the air. Mm-hmm. Clouds move a little higher because mm-hmm. they have to form, you know, where it's cooler. And our mountains aren't growing, so they pass us by. So I think people get it here. They know that something's afoot, something's changing, and they want to see action, and they want to see folks taking the sort of a longer-term plan to how we continue to maintain a quality of life here on the island.
Does it pose difficulties for a city government office in the climate of a federal government that doesn't get it?
Well, I think we realize that we're going to take care of ourselves, and we're in a place where we're going to, if we have to go it alone, it's too important of an issue. And I think that's part of the reason why voters in November approved the office, is they saw, even before the last federal election, you know, if we don't take care of business here at home, if, you know, because it's a local issue, you know, you can see the impacts are happening on the ground here. And so it impacts our, you know, infrastructure. Take a drive over on the windward side along Kualoa and see, you know, how the highway is faring with the king tides and the erosion over there. So we're going to be having to tweak our infrastructure. And it's not all a federal issue. I mean, this is a local issue that impacts every single one of us, and every single one of us is going to have to be part of the solution in our daily lives and through our jobs as we adapt and reorient.
Yeah, we're at this stage in a discussion where people say, what can I do? And you've already kind of indicated that what people can do is get with that survey that you're doing, right?
Well, for sure. I mean, I would love everybody to weigh in immediately on the survey to help give us guidance about what they think we should be doing. But it goes beyond that. I mean, you know, we are in a time of transition. France, China, Scotland have all said they're going to ban internal combustion cars because they know the threat of climate change is so great. We've got a great, you know, thanks to Mayor Caldwell and the administration, you know, we've got a great new Bicky bike share system that I rode over here on today.
All right.
It's a fun way to get around, and these are the things you can incorporate into everyday your practices that help us all out.
Josh, we'll check in with you periodically just to see how it's going. Thanks very much for coming in this morning.
I appreciate you. Thanks.
Josh Stambro serves as Mayor Kirk Caldwell's cabinet as the Chief Resilience Officer for the City and County of Honolulu, as well as Executive Director for the Office of Climate Change, Sustainability, and Resiliency.
Aloha, I'm Swain from Stage Left Productions. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's no secret that Hawaii's coral reefs and coral reefs around the world are under siege from human impacts, coral bleaching, and rising ocean temperatures. You can add another threat to that list locally, and it's a relatively recent one, leather mudweed, an invasive algae that's spreading rapidly around Oahu. Nathan Eagle has that story in this morning's Reality Check. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We've been hearing for years, particularly with regard to Kaneohe Bay, where they've been deploying that gizmo known as the super sucker to get algae out of the bay. What does algae do in those kind of concentrations?
Well, you could kind of look at it like a blanket for some of these kind of algaes anyway, like the leather mudweed. It just blankets things, smothers them, and kind of chokes out the available sunlight, which kind of in turn kills the reefs.
Well, why is it growing so fast? And you know, how did it get under control? Because we've known about this it's been around since the early 80s, yeah?
Yeah, it's been around for a really long time. It's totally out of control. There have been a lot of great efforts to get it under control and actually have in some areas like Mauna Loa Bay. But it's incredibly labor-intensive. You have to pull it by hand. The super suckers don't work for this one because it pulls up all this sediment and stuff like that with it. So what we really need, at least according to some of the experts I talked to, is healthy reef ecosystems to begin with. In particular, parrotfish, uhu. We need something to kind of just naturally eat this algae down.
Mm-hmm. And so are they going to be introduced, or how do you bring that about?
In this case, these won't be introduced. To fight a different algae, there was an introduction in Kaneohe Bay of a few hundred thousand sea urchins. And those have been, so far, pretty effective. At least that's what DLNR has said. Mm-hmm. But that's a different type of algae that it kind of works well there. Here, they think it could work. It's not really been proven, so they're not so sure. But they're looking more at rules to control the fishing of parrotfish and uhu, uhu in Hawaiian, of course. So we'll see how those rules come out. Soon is the word.
In the meantime, where is the problem at its most serious?
Well, it's back in Mauna Loa Bay, which they did have it semi under control. But it's also now at Barbers Point, it's at Bellows, it's at the northern part of Kaneohe Bay, and it's also actually at depths that they haven't seen before, up to even like 100 feet deep.
It's described as thriving in degraded marine environments. What does that mean, where the coral is already beleaguered?
Yeah, exactly. That coral rubble, those kind of areas that are already seriously struggling to come back, that's where it thrives. So it makes those chances of it coming back even harder.
Well, we'll want to keep up with the abatement effort on this. Thanks very much, Nathan.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nathan Eagle.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school. Now accepting applications, waldorfmaui.org.
Maui County Council Chair Mike White is a more than 30-year veteran of the visitor industry. He's been the general manager of the Kaanapali Beach Hotel since 1985. It's a unique vantage point and a platform from which to advocate for the visitor industry as an economic driver of the state, and as the Hawaii Tourism Conference convenes this week, for asking for his take on the current state of the visitor industry, his vision for its future. Hi, Mike. Thanks for talking with us.
Good morning, Chris. Happy to be with you.
How's the visitor industry doing today? It seems pretty robust. Am I right?
It's currently doing very well, and I think this conference is going to be focusing on a lot of issues around support of the host culture and sustainability, the various impacts, both positive and negative, on the communities in which the tourists spend a good portion of their time, and Also, it's a large gathering of all of our global travel partners from Asia, Oceania, the U.S., Canada, Europe, and Central and South America. So it's a great time for us to get together and discuss issues and re-energize our focus on things that are important to our communities, especially on the neighbor islands where the visitor population is a larger percentage of the overall population than it is on Oahu.
Well, for Maui, for example, Mike, what is the ratio for on a given day on Maui?
I don't recall the exact percentage, but I believe it's in the neighborhood of between 20% and 25% of the local population.
That's really pretty amazing. One out of four or five people is a visitor on any given day, isn't it?
Correct. So it's very important that we keep tabs on the impacts. And one of the difficulties that we have is that the visitors pay a significant amount of tax, and the TAT, and then, of course, the hotels pay a significant amount of property tax here on Maui.
Right.
And yet the TAT that is generated here, which this year will approximate about $148 million, and we'll get back about $23.5 million. So the visitors are paying for a lot of the services that we need to provide to make it more comfortable for the residents to host the visitors, and yet we're just simply not getting the support back from the state that we feel we should have.
And Mike, that figure you just mentioned is Maui's share of an annual $103 million that is now by law capped at that figure, $103.
That's correct, and it's been capped for about 10 years. And so while the state increased their share from $17 million in 2007 to about $291 million last year, and approximately be about $320 million this coming year or this fiscal year. And we've gotten an increase of about $2 million in that same time frame.
Does that kill some of your incentive to, say, beef up your infrastructure, attract more visitors? It doesn't do you any good to attract more visitors, I would think.
Well, it does take away some of the incentive for us to continue to invest in the product. Although, you know, most of us feel that we have to do that anyway. The difficult part is that by not sharing the TAT like is done in all other counties on the mainland, we're really forced to shift the cost of providing visitors, the police, fire, and parks services to the residents and the resident businesses. And that's just simply, in our view, not appropriate, not fair.
The thing, Mike, the thing that has baffled me about the whole arrangement with the transit accommodations tax, the TAT, has been that $103 million figure as a flat figure rather than a percentage. You know, $103 million isn't going to mean as much a year from now, 5 years from now, right? As inflation tends to proceed in only one direction.
One direction.
Right?
That's right, Chris. And, you know, the other thing that makes it patently unfair is that during that time when the counties have received only a $2.2 million increase, the increased cost to operate our police, fire, and parks departments only in the four counties has increased by approximately $390 million in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there again, it's just the TAT was set up to support the county's need for a convention center on Oahu or other things on the neighbor islands, but mainly to provide the support for the police, fire, and parks and other things that support a healthy visitor industry.
Well, given, Mike, that you're essentially getting a sum of money that means less each year and have more needs to meet with that sum of money, at what point does the number of tourists become too much?
Well, the number of tourists currently is not increasing at a very fast clip because we're not building too many more facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing for us is that the visitor industry on the neighbor islands supports a significant portion of the economy. And I would I've heard figures as high as 75% of the Maui economy is either directly or indirectly supported by the visitor industry. So it's critical that we keep maintaining that focus, because so many people's livelihoods and, you know, both their salaries, wages, benefits, and all their house payments and so forth depend on it.
Sure. None of us is entirely separate from the visitor industry, I would think, in the state. You know, not more than 1 or 2 degrees of separation away from it, no matter who you are.
Correct.
Well, given that, Mike, you know, the whole question of saturation and the whole question of tourism, as in spite of the fact that it's been robust for a long time, it rides on the tides of, you know, public perception. It could be vulnerable if suddenly people decide to go somewhere else. There's really no predicting that, is there?
No, it's a very fragile industry when you come right down to it. We benefit because we're seen as a very beautiful, comfortable, and safe destination in comparison to many others. But as those other destinations take care of their security and safety issues, and others grow and begin updating their methods of competing with us, we certainly stand to lose in that equation. So it's a situation where we've got to be ever vigilant.
Well, the conference this week is likely to get a lot of these ideas, throw a lot of those plates in the air, and get a lot of different perspectives on it. So we'll see. We'll see what we learn, won't we?
It should be very interesting. We'll have issues like Airbnb and the RBO issues of folks staying in personal homes and unfortunately taking up, in some cases, units that could be long-term rentals. And so those are issues that are front and center for the counties and certainly front and center for the state legislature.
Well, Mike, we'll keep in touch about this, and thanks very much for taking the time this morning.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you very much.
You bet. Mike White is the general manager of the Ka'anapali Beach Hotel in West Maui and the chair of the Maui County Council, representing Makawao, Haiku, and Paia.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our planet, plus what's happening in our dark island skies. As usual, turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. He's on the line right now. Welcome back, Christopher. What do you have in store this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for the ring giant Saturn setting around 11:15 p.m. in the west. The moon passing through its new moon phase this week.
This week, I understand, you've got another historic mission that's been going on for a while, and it's kind of being reawakened.
It certainly is. As the legendary Cassini mission drew to a close last week, another one of NASA's deep space probes awoke from a long slumber to continue its own mission into the outer reaches of the solar system. The New Horizons spacecraft, which wowed us with its incredible images of the dwarf planet Pluto, has stirred from hibernation to prepare itself for its encounter with the Kuiper Belt object. These mysterious celestial bodies reside in the dark outer reaches of the solar system, a place where the sun appears just like any other star.
So what's it going to do when it gets there?
Well, the spacecraft is set for a rendezvous with an object called MU69, and this will happen in 2019. All we know about this object is that it's very far away and roughly around 20 miles long. We have no idea what it's made of or even if it's one object at all.
And it's probably just some rocks, right?
Well, we really don't know. Kuiper Belt objects are supremely mysterious. We think that they are leftover relics of the formation of the solar system, so their composition could be ice, it could be rock, it could be a little bit of metal, it could be something else entirely. And that's what New Horizons is going to find out.
Take us through the kind of preparation that the recently reawakening spacecraft will be undergoing?
Well, first of all, the ground team needs to know that the spacecraft is in good health, and that means performing some diagnostics. So they're going to test all its various instruments to make sure that they're all still functioning after a long journey in space.
Does that mean there's some images we might have?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, New Horizons will get three times closer to this mysterious object than it did with Pluto, so we can expect some pretty cool images when the time comes.
And then what'll happen after that?
New Horizons is expected to go interstellar. It will leave the solar system and join the Voyager probes as they head out into the galaxy.
It's Christopher Phillips here, another exciting report. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Culinary Institute of the Pacific. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, providing research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In late 19th century Hawaii, it was the social center for Honolulu's well-to-do, the racetrack at the foot of Diamond Head. From 1883 until its demolition in 1914, it was the place to be for Honolulu's moneyed class. It had a grandstand and a clubhouse, and members of the park association that owned the land could lease land and build cottages on nearby Waikiki Beach. It was a one-mile oval track, and one of its signature events was the annual Rosita Cup, held each year on King Kamehameha Day, June 11th. The racetrack had been built by an association of local landowners with the blessing of King Kalakaua, himself a racing enthusiast. Their leader was one Archibald Scott Cleghorn, a friend of the monarchy who presided over the extensive landscaping of the 300-acre park. The hoofbeats have long since died down, but today Kapi'olani Park remains one of the city's most widely used public spaces. And Jenny Peterson was firstest with the mostest, getting that right. Jenny Peterson of Manoa will win our prize today, and that's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The Hawaii Arts Alliance has been pursuing its mission since 1980, a mission it describes as building creativity through advocacy, community, and education for all the arts. It's a mission that grows in importance as schools move away from arts education, and Noe Tanigawa talked with its new CEO, Terry Liu, and its departing leader, Marilyn Cristofori.
When I took over Hawaii Alliance for Arts Education as it was originally founded, it had a very small budget, $30,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Now it's approaching $2 million.
And this is a private nonprofit in town.
Private nonprofit.
With the goal of arts education originally.
Originally, the founder was Alfred Price, well known for designing the Arizona Memorial, and a well known architect.
What was the arts landscape like? What kind of arts were being made, and what was
it
going
was
on?
The era of councils for the arts, and they were more separated. There was a dance council and a theater council and so on by art form. That has changed tremendously. The thinking from the research into the arts, that it's not so much about the arts for art's sake, but it's how it changes, shapes, and affects the quality of our lives.
Oh, that's so interesting. So it's the effect of art. And that, of course, is what you end up dealing with at the National Endowment, right? That's what people measure, the effect of programs funding the arts. How have you seen, on the national scene, changes in that direction?
The National Endowment for the Arts supports arts all around the country. So, you know, policy isn't really set in the United States of America. You know, we don't have an arts czar or an arts minister. Arts happen locally. You know, I think the first time I came to Hawaii, my mom brought me to see all my relatives, you know, was in the 60s. And so you can see the decades of change that happened and what kind of arts are going on in Hawaii. As an integration, arts are even more important than ever now because we're trying to develop children. It's a creative youth development to be citizens of the future that have empathy and self-expression. So it's always changing.
And that is a great way that the Arts Alliance has helped to actually increase the visibility of arts in the population. One was through the programs that you run for the school children, also by supporting the powwow initiatives there in Kaka'ako. Mm-hmm. You jumped in early on that, Marilyn.
Oh, we were very happy to do that. We were able to obtain, on behalf of powwow's work, an Our Town grant from the National Endowment for the Arts.
It's $100,000 grants, Our Town grants.
It's a one-time?
Not necessarily, but you know, when it's made at the federal level, National Endowment for the Arts, they're looking across the country and awarding a few of these major mm-hmm. grants that are making a difference, bringing arts and community together. And, you know, Kamehameha Hadar and Jasper Wong and what they did in Power, there's two brilliant people who came up with this amazing idea, which really starts to bring back together community and advocacy as well as what, you know, part of what we do at the Hawaii Arts Alliance. So there's nothing that expresses what we do better than things like powwow. Yeah.
So true. And it's so visible for people in the community.
It answers a little bit your first question, Noe. At the time that I started 24 years ago, the arts were pretty much functioning as silos in their particular discipline and skills that go to that discipline. At one point, I was a ballet snob, and almost everybody I know was a snob about whatever visual art or music or opera or whatever. And I have changed so much. Now, I think that it's absolutely essential to retain those silos, because if you do want to be an opera singer, you've got to go get voice training. You're not going to be an opera singer with arts integration. But the quality of life and the integration with communities and how the expression, how people live and how they think and how they behave is really based on the creative aspect, the process of art making. And every child deserves that in their life.
Huh. Breaking down, you know, the silos. And that's true for all the arts. So, you know, there are people that don't feel comfortable going to museums or seeing the symphony. They feel it's not for them. And we really have to break down these false artificial barriers. Something like powwow is really good for doing that, because you see it's on the street, but it's really outstanding art. And people from all walks of life come to see it, around the world they come to see it, you know. Jasper and Kamehameha going all around the world taking this model, Hawaii exporting this model around the world. So we have to break down all these concepts of, you know, this is not for me, this is mine, and that's not for me, and we can just share, you know, because art is a human expression. And
did
so we started that at an early age with little kids, and they take that, and then with the adults too, we have to just find ways to make it affordable and break down barriers. Uh-huh. But it's never too late, you know? You know. And then sometimes we find out that people are very creative, and that they don't call themselves artists. You know, there's people that are playing music or detail, you know, putting detail on their cars and cutting metal, and they're doing art. They're like sculptors, you know.
Well, are you
but they
saying,
don't think of themselves as artists. So it's about creativity,
Is this a great moment for art in Honolulu? I mean, because we've got Kaka'ako coming. There are a lot of artists who have sold artwork this past year that maybe unexpectedly. Yep. We had the Honolulu Biennial. We had Aikai that pop up there at Foodland. I mean,
it's a really, really good time.
As you look across the landscape, Marilyn, you know, who are the best supporters of art in our community?
We don't always hear about all of them, and that gets to be Terry's job. There are many, and there are many more than are public. Some of them don't care to be public.
Well, are these people going to be around?
They're still here.
Okay. Would you say that we're on good funding footing then here in Hawaii for the arts?
We're very fortunate, but it's never a done deal.
And I'm looking, you know, looking back to the last 24 years and looking, what is the next 24 years, 25 years going to look like? You know, we have kids in elementary school we're bringing arts to. We don't have any idea what the world's going to be like, but we're trying to give them things, tools that they can, aesthetic learning techniques that they can bring, put in everything in their lifetime. Now, we were just talking about the millennial generation and the children of the millennials and what is it that inspires them to give, you know? And I think there are causes, you know, there are causes and that make people give from the heart. They always have been, but I think millennials more than ever, you know, they're looking for something that they believe in. And, you know, I think that if we talk about arts in terms of children, their children, and themselves, and all of us, you know, how arts are so important as expression and how it's going to, what it's what we need more than ever right now, because all the lack of empathy, you know, and the lack of feeling that you belong, lack of ability to express yourself creatively. We all need this right now, and in every way we have to find ways to do that. I think that's something people can get behind and support. Everybody can.
And we have started that recently with our reaching across disciplines. Our integration of arts and science is very, very successful and very important for teachers to have in the classroom. If they can teach a class that meets the educational standards for an art form and for a non-art form, science, math, whatever, at the same time in the same lesson, it's very successful integration, and it inspires the children to learn what they don't learn any other way.
Oh, now that's the kind of great groundbreaking work that we hope to see more of here in Hawaii. Thank you so much, the both of you, for your efforts and for the efforts that are ahead for you, Terry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn, Christy.
I'm going to enjoy watching it go to the next level.
Terry Leo recently became the Hawaii Arts Alliance interim CEO. Marilyn Cristofori served the Alliance from 1994 to July of 2017.
Aloha, I'm Karen Meyer from the Castle Performing Arts Center. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
And that's it for this morning. As a reminder, we are no longer rebroadcast at 7 p.m., so I get to say good morning. Tonight, we will air the program on the media at 7 p.m. Up tomorrow, Monsanto's Vice President of Global Research and Development will join us. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow morning.